I'm Guy Barter and welcome to Gardening with the RHS. One thing I really love about gardening is the huge array of topics that you can get positively geeky over. Recently, I've been really interested in peonies, so I bought a collection of rather expensive plants and they're still going all right, but now, much more economically, I've become obsessed by cover crops for my allotment and spend unfeasible amounts of time growing oats and ryegrass to try and improve the soil, save money, improve the environment and grow better veg. Results are promising, shall we say. Anyway, back to this podcast. Today we're going to help you grow your green knowledge with our gardening advisors, and we'll explore some of the fascinating interactions between plants and animals. We'll also be hearing the incredible story of how one woman overcame class, race and gender boundaries to become a pioneering botanist in the next part of our Unsung Heroes of Horticulture series. I'm always learning something new from my colleagues here at the RHS. We have experts in just about every single gardening topic you can think of. If I have any tricky gardening questions, I just have a chat with our advisory team. In between answering my queries, they've been hard at work answering all of yours. Let's hear what they've been asked recently.
Hi, I'm Lee Hunt, and today I've got with me Becky Meady and Jenny Bowden.
Hello.
Hello.
And this question comes from Celia Ashley from Bromley Cross.
I have a couple of roses that have not done well in their current location. I feel like I've made a mistake planting them in a north-facing garden. To the back, I have a south-facing garden, and I would like to relocate those roses. When is the best time to do that?
Now. Now, you could do it now. They're all dormant, leaves have fallen off, no time at the present, so and then ready for them getting growing next spring.
It does depend how long they've been in for as to how well they'll relate to actually being moved. Roses are one of those plants that really don't like being moved very much. Roses have got very deep roots and they're quite woody with few fibrous roots. So as long as you're aware of that, then you can dig quite deeply so that you don't break that woody taproot. But as Becky says, it is the perfect time to have a go at it. And hopefully if you water well next season, they should come back with a flourish.
Yeah, that's the crucial thing, isn't it, for next season, for watering and establishing.
Can we grow roses in north-facing positions? Is that a good thing to do?
Ideally, you need a good half a day of sunshine, but there are a few roses that you can grow in shadier positions. Some of the David Austin ones will thrive in about 4 or 5 hours of sunshine a day. The rugosa roses in general are okay with 4 or 5 hours of good sunshine. Emily Bronte is a pale pink David Austin type rose. Country Parson, Kew Gardens, a Shropshire Lad.
This question comes from Louise Houghton from Mid Wales.
I'm attempting to establish a herb garden in some planters next year. They are 3 feet off the ground and approximately 4 by 1.5 feet. I'm just looking for a few hints and tips on their hardiness, companionable planting, plus perennial annual selections and anything I need to watch out for. Thanks.
So we've got this container. What's the best way to prepare it before we actually choose the plants to go in it?
Well, before you start, put it in a nice sunny position before you start filling it with compost. Herbs, in general, love sunshine. Compost-wise, ideally, something like a John Innes compost that's kind of loamy, but with perlite, keep it nice and light, or you can use grit, but you want a nice open texture for herbs in the main. And then you can set about choosing some plants. Above all, what do you like cooking? What do you enjoy eating? That would be one of my main ways of choosing. My preference is probably in a container like that, perhaps not to go for big, chunky plants like rosemary. I think they're probably better out in the main flower bed. But things like parsley, chives, chervil, French tarragon, Those are the sort of things that you get to put together for French sort of fines herbes, for salads and poultry and things like that. If you like those sorts of herbs and those kind of meals, it really just depends what you like cooking.
And now for our next question.
Hello, my name is Sue Wyatt and I live in a small village in the Swansea Valley, South Wales. We have a huge passion flower growing up a trellis in a south-facing position in our garden. It's been there for more than 5 years and is in very good condition with plenty of growth and masses of flower buds. My question is, why don't the flower buds open? I'm very puzzled.
So these flower buds, why do they typically not open?
Well, they do take their time in opening, so they kind of open up in sequence. So you don't tend to have a whole passion flower covered in flowers. They tend to open as their time goes and they kind of, you know, you get one at once type thing. So I'm wondering whether it's just got too much nitrogen feed potentially and then not enough potash and needs just a little bit, maybe it's just some tomato food just to kind of help the flowering.
Because Sue is in Swansea, we know that she's in a relatively mild area of the country, but passiflora or passion flowers are still pretty much borderline hardy in much of the UK. So we would sort of say around the coast, towns and cities are a good place to try this. If people want to have a go, what are the hardier passifloras to look out for?
Any of the Carolea types, which is the sort of classic one that you'll most commonly find in the garden centres, there are some quite nice cultivars. There's one called Constance Elliot, which is pure white and it's scented as well. So anything that says Passiflora, Carolea, and then the cultivar, and that determines the colour or perhaps the scent, they're all good ones.
We have a question from Sean James Cameron from Crystal Palace.
Over the last few months, I've started to develop an interest in grasses. And at the moment, I'm growing low grass, but I'm looking for suggestions on maybe a grass that's around about 6 foot tall. Anything but pampas grass.
So, obviously pampas grass, which is, I think, is making a real comeback, is out here. But obviously that's quite a big, wide plant as well. What else could they grow that reaches the height but perhaps doesn't dominate the garden?
So yesterday, when on my way to get the post from Wisley, I went through the grass borders down in the Howard's Field and had a look at what they've got growing there that look really good at the moment. One of them is the Miscanthus Professor Richard Hansen. So that's got a really quite nice tussly head and that's quite a nice red as it opens and then it fades. It tends to have quite a good old clearance of a stem before the actual flower. So they stand quite proud and they were standing up really quite well at the moment. And the other one that I like the look of down there is not quite as 6 footer, but that's the Panicum Virgatum North Wind, and that made nice kind of like a hummock, and they've got a very nice spindly kind of flower. It's very more airy is the Panicum flower.
For slightly earlier flowers in quite a strong purple, Calamagrostis is a good one. Calamagrostis Carl Furster. That flowers in sort of June, July time. A lot of the grasses flower later in the season. Also, you could have foliage which has got silver veins in it, so you've got that extra interest in the garden as well. For example, Miscanthus malapartus, and that gets to sort of between 6 and 7 feet. And the Panicum as well. Although I was interested to hear what Becky was saying about the Panicum. I've always been inspired to grow them because of the grasses that we can see displayed at Wisley, so I bought myself some.
If you want to submit a question for our advisors, just record yourself asking one on your phone or tablet and email it to podcast@rhs.org.uk. Now it's time for the next part of our Unsung Heroes of Horticulture series. Janaki Amal was the first female scientist at RHS Garden Wisley and she revolutionised the way sugarcane is grown in India. Mandeep Mafaru is a herbarium curator at Wisley, who wrote a blog about her life and has spoken to some of Dr. Amal's descendants. She tells us Janaki's extraordinary story.
What basically fascinated me towards Jahnke was it was my very first year at Wisley. My main role at that time was to go into the cupboards and take the types and the standard specimens out. These are very, very crucial specimens for any herbarium because they serve as the reference point to name a new cultivar. And one day when I was just opened this particular rhododendron, I just saw the name, Jahnke Amul. Personally, being brought up back in India, I could just find the resemblance that this is somebody who's got the South Asian inheritance. So I Googled her. And at that time, the only detail I could get was she was the first kind of female botanist who worked at Wisley. And I thought, okay, Jahnke, so you were the first female scientist. And I am actually the second woman from the Indian inheritance working at Wisley in 2011. Myself coming from a background where my grandfather and my grandparents been really strict about everything and, you know, the way you're not allowed to go out on your own. You're supposed to behave a certain way, to dress up in a certain way. And I thought that what she must have gone through, having the race and the caste discrimination and then on her own in this big world, I just kept putting myself into her shoes, that how she must have felt at that time. She started her bachelor's in her 1920s. So she basically, whilst all her other sisters were getting married, she was more leaned towards getting more education, and she actually chose education over getting settled in life and being married. This was not common. First of all, just getting a bachelor's, getting a master's, because she belonged to a lower caste, a family, it wasn't a norm, and she broke that norm basically. So basically, after finishing her doctorate, that actually made her the first Indian woman to receive a doctorate in the field of botany. She came back to India. She ended up getting a position of cytologist in the Sugarcane Breeding Institute. She's been designated as the lady who made the sugarcane sweeter. The sugarcane was imported from abroad, and she was sure that she can come up with some high-yielding varieties that would help us to grow those varieties back in India. And the sugarcane variety that she worked with, that actually led to a major cutback because we were able to grow the sugarcane back in India and they didn't need to actually get it imported from outside. Although she was doing such significant work, she wasn't very well taken by her male peers, who were a bit jealous of her work. So she wasn't really happy with that. And she ended up at the Jonins Institute here in the UK. Over here, she had a very interesting collaboration with C.D. Darlington and J.B.S. Haldane. They actually resulted into a very crucial publication called The Chromosome Atlas of Cultivated Plants in 1945. So that was at Jonins. And then when she came to Wisley, and the major contribution towards horticulture, I think, because as we know that RHS specializes in cultivars and we take pride in that, she was able to actually produce a new cultivar. So it's the Rhododendron Yakushinanum, the Koichi Rowada, is the cultivar that she worked on. This particular cultivar was chosen in 2016 and it was voted as the number one rhododendron, basically. So that was a major, major contribution. It was a major outbreak for her. She was very active even after her retirement. I just actually found out a little bit about how she saved a valley. So according to the papers, basically in 1970, Indian government had planned to flood about like 8.3 kilometers of land, basically an evergreen tropical forest, and they wanted to convert it into a hydroelectric plant. But when John Key came to know about this, she just said that she can't be silenced on this one. And she really wants to help the people. So used her status as the valued national scientist. And she focused on, you know, making a call for preservation of that particular land. People actually listened to her. The project was abandoned. And it's called Silent Valley. It's actually a national park in Kerala at the moment. And it's just bursting with endangered orchids, and they've got thousands of endemic flowering plants. This would have never been possible with her contribution. I'm talking about in 1970, so she must have been like about 80 years old. This lady, she never stopped. Whichever part of the world she was in, she would just concentrate on her work, and that's what she did in her last days. She had like this very meek personality, but she had that presence. You would know that she's in the room. Quite a huge, huge personality, I would say. She will always be remembered as the female botanist who sweetened the nation, who made sugarcane sweeter. She will always be remembered for her work with the Sugarcane Breeding Institute. We will always remember her for her fabulous work through the lovely Magnolia Cobus, which is named after her at Battleston Hill at Wisley. And it's a very lovely, fragrant reminder of her and of her contribution. All those lovely dried press specimens that we have, that every time we take them out from the herbarium cupboards, you'll see her initials. And it just makes you feel her presence as she was here. And then finally, saving a valley in her 80s. I mean, how amazing is that? She does need that recognition to make people aware what she has done and just kind of encourage people that if she can do it, you can do it as well.
Mandeep Mafaru. Hearing about Janaki reminded me how steeped in history the laboratory at RHS Wisley is, and of all the remarkable people who did so much important work in the early days. Before I leave you today, let's take a quick trip to Botany Corner with a favourite of the show, Dr. Chris Farragud from the University of Oxford. I always love learning from Chris. So far, he's spoken about plant defences, poisons, spines, toxins, and plant survival. Remember the seeds that lived for thousands of years? And today, Chris is here to tell us about the pretty incredible ways some plants and animals work together to support each other.
Today, we're going to be talking about mutualism between plants and animals. So mutualism is a special relationship that has evolved in the animal and the plant kingdom as a sort of quid pro quo, where both the plant and the animal benefit from their relationship. And one of the most fascinating examples I know is in a group of plants called ant plants. So these plants have evolved symbioses, these special relationships that I referred to earlier, also called mutualism. So how does this work? Well, these plants produce special hollow structures that are specifically grown for housing ants. So they produce these sort of elaborate hotels or houses, if you like, for ants. And they come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. So some plants produce hollow thorns, others produce little chambers inside their stems, some of them even in their tubers or their leaves. Now, why would a plant produce these structures for ants to live in? Well, the clue is this. If you've ever disturbed an ant's nest, you'll know that ants will defend their colony voraciously and they will attack any threat to the ant's nest. And this really works to the plant's advantage because any would-be predator that tries to take a mouthful out of the plant will be viciously attacked by the ants. They patrol the stems of the ant plant and attack anything that tries to eat the plant because, of course, this is their home and so they are protecting their colony. And so this is to the advantage of the plant. And the plant can also produce all sorts of other rewards for the ants that patrol its stems. So, for example, they produce sugary nectar, rather like flowers do, but they produce it in special structures on the stems. And they have food bodies, so little structures that the ants can eat. So all sorts of things that really make the ants feel at home living in the plant. How else do the ants benefit the plant? Well, for those that have hollow chambers that the ants live inside, they bring in all sorts of detritus, bits of leaf, sort of remains of things that they've eaten, and also their feces, the ants' droppings. And all of these break down and are a source of food for the plants. And many of these plants, they grow perched high up on tree branches, for example, on mossy branches in cloud forests in the tropics. And these environments are quite poor in nutrients. So there's not much in the way of, for example, nitrogen and phosphorus and things like that plants need to grow well. And so by having these ants living inside their stems, this is an extra source of food for the plant. So these are some fascinating examples of plants in the plant kingdom that have evolved relationships with animals where both the animal and the plant benefit.
Thanks, Chris. That's all we have time for. For more on today's show, visit rhs.org.uk/podcast. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Guy Barter.